month. Naya, so we partner and we do up at Mamuk Tokatee here in the Cully neighborhood. We do the open mic up there. Shout out Drea, who's super dope peoples, who brings us in amazing. Like she feeds folks, like, yo, auntie, big auntie energy. Like, yo, let's get folks fed while we're here too. So much love. Shout out to A Beat Happening and Jonas. We've been partnered with them in rolling as well. Ethos Music, we've been over in their space with Fire. Shout out Fire, appreciate you and the work that you all are doing over at Ethos. Ascending Flow has been deeply in partnership and rocking with My Voice Music. We're about to have an office space over there next month. My Voice Music is a dope partner. We've been doing a lot of the workshops in their space. They're a huge part of us being able to do the work that we do right now. So shout out Amy, crew over there. Much love to y'all. World Stage Theater. Can't leave the Sims family out, man. Good people, good people over there. One of the only Black-owned theater companies, Portland, World Stage Theater. They're always doing great work over there. So shout out to them and the way that they show up. And that space is one of our favorite spaces to be in. Had some amazing performances over there. I mentioned Andre and Friends of Noise. A Beat Happening is about to be opening up. That's going to be another dope space for youth to connect to and perform. Yeah, so we partnered with a lot of really amazing folks. You heard is going to be an Ascending Flow program. Super fire concept and really loving the direction that it's moving in right now as well.
All right, buddy. We'll keep up the great work. Looking forward to more updates when they're up and coming with all the great work that's ongoing. And folks, you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Special thanks to our amazing guest and to Prison Pipeline Collective member Karen James for post-production. Free them all.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive is coming. Tune in August 20th, where we'll bring you testimonials, anecdotes, facts, and more, all day long to celebrate National Radio Day. KBOO, made by people like you, for people like you.
One, two, three.
Boat. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Rise up, stand tall, we won't back down. No fear, no doubt, we stand our ground. No justice, no peace, no private police. Hands off our homes, we run these streets. Run these streets. Ain't no badge gonna make us free. We know what real safety ought to be. No more cops to flood our streets. We want justice, not more police.
No more police.
Daisy D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. There's a movement in Atlanta that's been vibrant and has been going on for at least the past 5 years. Many people may have heard the name Cop City, but they haven't really known what that entails. We might hear of a highlight here and there, you know, maybe a vehicle being burnt or somebody going to jail, but that's about it. There's a book out that chronicles what's going on and goes into depth about a movement that I think has impact all around the country. It is called No Cop City, No Cop World, Lessons from the Movement. And it's edited by Kamal Franklin, who is our guest this afternoon. And you have another editor on here, but when I pull it up, it ain't showing me who it is. It's showing me a bunch of names. So I'm gonna have you do the honors, Kamal. I write down the notes, and then when I do the show, the notes get combobbled.
The other editors are Mariah Parker and Micah Herndon.
Oh, okay. They do have it. Mariah Parker and Micah Hergen. Okay, thank you. A couple of things come to mind. First, can we get a little Cop City 101 in the movement, more importantly, that's around this?
Yeah, a Cop City 101 would be, you know, during the 2020 uprisings when George Floyd was murdered, Breonna Taylor was murdered here in Atlanta, Rashad Brooks was murdered by the police. When millions of people all across the world actually came out of their homes during a pandemic to protest these murders, to call for the defunding of the police, the abolition of the police, alternatives to police. The state in Atlanta and now other states have subsequently also done this. The Atlanta decided, when I say the state, of course, it's a euphemism for government. I know Atlanta is a city. But the state reaction to it was to double down on their oppressive tactics and to believe that they needed actually better or more oppressive tactics to control the uprisings that were taking place. And out of that was born or redrafted the idea of building a Cop City, which is a militarized police training ground that was hundreds of acres in a forest that was adjacent to a working class Black community that was promised to that Black community. So instead, they tore down parts of that forest to attempt to build this Cop City, which they themselves said was a militarized, military-grade police training center where they had mock cities to practice crowd control, urban warfare tactics. Again, where part of that work was to bring in police departments from all across the country and other European police agencies, Germany, France, including the Israeli police and IDF, to do joint trainings on population control. So the reaction from the larger community, the organizing community, was to fight back against this, and hence the Cop City movement was born.
There's a lot of layers and levels to this. On one hand, you're in Georgia, with a very, in my opinion, very oppressive state government, you know, Brian Kemp and his cronies. And what I remember after the George Floyd, or during the George Floyd uprising, there was a call to defund the police. And it was also a movement that many people have not talked about. Within a year, there were 30 or 40 progressive prosecutors elected all around the country, right? And that caused concern with police and others. So what I remember, you tell me if I'm wrong, was Georgia was one of the first places to say, we ain't defunding no police and we're going to put it into legislation, right? And I was like, whoa, you know? And then we started to hear noise about trying to strip prosecutors. Now, it might have been Florida that did it or Georgia, I'm not sure. Same thing to me. But it was a move to limit the type of prosecution that, type of actions the prosecutor could take in terms of going after police. So that's one layer and level. You have this, we ain't having it on our watch. But what stands out to me about Cop City is that Atlanta is the chocolate city, right? Mm-hmm. It is the chocolate city. You know, it's kind of displaced Washington, D.C. and Detroit and all these other places that have traditionally been. That's the Mecca. And when I started hearing about Cop City, I'm thinking it's a Brian Kemp thing, or, you know, and the governor and all that. And I'm like, wait a second, this is like the sister, you know, Keisha Bottoms, the
Keisha
mayor.
Keisha Bottoms, yeah.
You're right. It's Black folks in Atlanta. And that complicates a lot of things in terms of, you know, might be understood in Atlanta, but from the outside looking in, you have people walking around, you know, vote for everything Black. You know, listen to Black women, the whole nine. Mm-hmm. And if this Black woman in the era of vote for everything Black says we need a Cop City, well, damn it, we need a Cop City, because we're assuming she did her due diligence, which is the fascination of this movement, because now the types of political nuance that's needed and real sharp understanding of who the players are and aren't is something that you all have been executing for 5 years. And I think a lot of places have to play catch up, because we're real quick to jump behind folks under the guise of we need representation. We need a brown face, Black face, gay face, or whatever. And That seems to have, at least that seems to be a pitch battle in Atlanta. I don't know if it's been completely done away with, but that's where the movement seems to be focused on really understanding those nuances.
Yeah, I think you've said similarly, you've laid out a lot of layers. And let me take one and then come back to what we call the Black misrepresentation or class or the Black bourgeois political elite class or whatever. So the first level, like when you talked about the prosecutors, the other thing that came up during that time period was the extraordinary way in which police foundations received multi-million dollar funding, right? And so during that time period, not only the attack on prosecutors and the attack on defunding, but these political interests decided, just in case any city, any municipality would even defund a little bit, that there were alternative ways in which policing would be funded by a nonprofit agency or institution that was effectively controlled by police. And so
Whoa. Let's rewind again for people in the back.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going, let's defund the police, Kamal. We control the government. We got people in office. This is what we're going to do. And we're going to redirect those funds towards other things. And the counter was to be like, if you defund us, we got a pipeline to get lots of money anyway.
Exactly. By these nonprofits. And again, these police foundations existed before the 2020 uprisings, but they were relatively small and unimportant when it came to the funding of policing agencies, which obviously depends on money from the city itself and or the state and or county. But these police foundations in Atlanta, the police foundation played a particular role of being in charge of building Cop City, right? They were the ones who collected the private funds. They even get state funds and city funding, but they are an outside agency. And so for the first time in history, you have a private foundation which is responsible for the training of the municipal police department. And who is the chief funders of these foundations? They're major corporations, not local corporations, but they're major Fortune 500 corporations, some of which are based in Atlanta, everything from Cox Enterprises to Coca-Cola for a while, to Delta, to Waffle House. And so the other important aspect of that, Waffle House, my man, Waffle House.
Oh, wow.
Which seems like a working class place where folks go and, you know, eat and do other things. But obviously they're owned, you know, if anybody looks at the history, they're owned by a right-wing family who uses those resources for right-wing interests. And so it's important to note that the system itself had other strategies for containing anything that movement could win in terms of the idea of defunding or, again, putting money into other enterprises. And again, to make sure that we're clear, it wasn't like these cities were willing to do that anyway. They gave some lip service, but they weren't necessarily willing to do it. But the state said, or the reaction was, just in case, let's have these other vehicles. When it comes to the what I call the Black bourgeois of the elected officials, I think you're right. Part of the struggle has now morphed into having a clear understanding of the role of Black elected officials, liberal Black elected officials, right? Who use the fact that they're Black, they went to the same high school as somebody, that they are, you know, they went to junior high school, they lived on this block, as the monikers of showing how Black they are. But they basically are serving the interests of developers and capitalists here in the United States, here in Atlanta in particular. But you know, that truth is, of course, true for liberal politicians of any color, but it's particularly important for us as a people to understand it, because it is the racial dynamic is used, like get the first Black this or to think that we're in charge. We're under this Black leadership. And again, using Atlanta as the example, when you talked about Atlanta being the Black Mecca, it is under this Black leadership over the last 60 years. Black mayors and majority Black city councils, mostly in the last 60 years, that gentrification, which has led to the depopulation of Black Atlanta, has taken place. Atlanta has gone from being 60% Black to approximately 48% Black during that time span. All public housing has been destroyed under Black leadership during the building of the Olympics. Homeless folks who unfortunately were majority Black, were ushered out of the city. They were jailed. They were given one-way bus tickets to leave Atlanta and to never come back. And so it shows that just because you have obviously a Black face in a high place, that they may not be acting in the interest of everyday working class and poor Black people. And I think the Cop City struggle is another perfect example of that, where again, the reaction of the city was to join with police forces, the conservative state, these nonprofit institutions, and to say, what we need to do during this moment is not think about a new way in which policing happened, but to double down to make sure these type of mass uprisings are better controlled, so we can push people off the street faster, we can jail them faster, we can criminalize them faster. That was the reaction by the state, whether they were Republican, right-wing, overt white supremacists, or so-called neoliberal Black Democrats who said they had the interests of Black people. It was cops and capitalism that ruled the day during that time period.
That's the voice of Kamal Franklin. He's one of the co-authors of the book, No Cop City, No Cop World, Lessons Learned from the Movement. Had a number of questions that I wanted to ask you, because the book really focuses on how you all do coalition building and you know, details, you know, stuff. That's the lesson part. But as you're talking, and you're from New York like myself as well, mm-hmm. The big battleground where what you all have, we're dealing with in Atlanta, may be manifesting itself in, I think, a winner take all, you know, it's going to be a very decisive mayoral battle. If I paint the picture, here you have somebody who managed to get the Democratic nomination for the first time without Black voters, without the majority of Black voters. And you have a number of folks going, oh, wow, this is the formula. We don't need these people anymore to buttress, you know, to win a political victory in a major urban center that has a lot of Black people. You know, New York still has lots of Black folks there. So that's one complication. Two, almost every Black elected official has stood up before the cameras, from Hakeem Jeffries to Gregory Meeks, you name it. They've all stood up and they said, we're going to stand behind Cuomo, the mm-hmm. same Cuomo, you know, who was convicted of, you know, all the sexual harassment, had to leave office, who covered up the deaths of people, and has never really been a big fan, friend of Black folks. But to see Black politician after Black politician after Black politician come up and say, we're going to get behind him, it is baffling when his politics and or policies have nothing to do with Black folks. So that's two. And then we also see a coalescing around Eric Adams, a former policeman who at one point, you know, tried to move in a direction of being radical and wound up just now just being a cop's cop, and has his own, you know, crazy stuff, where so much to the point that he's in bed with Donald Trump. So I bring this up because these Black folks, the Hakeem Jeffries, when you see them speak, you know, they have that persona, like, yo, I'm a brother from the block, you know, and we need to stand with Israel. He'll say it like that. And you're like, huh? Yeah. You know, I'm a brother from the block. So we're going to get behind Hakeem Jeffries and this other guy. He's bad for us. So if you don't know, you're thinking like, well, this dude, he's from Brooklyn. He sounds like he's from around the way. As you said, he went to the school with some of these folks. He seems like, you know, he can do the latest dances. He was at the Jay-Z concert. He must be down. Mm-hmm. And because so much of what people do in general is emotional, mm-hmm. that complicates the situation. And lastly, if you have allies, brown folks and others who have not really engaged our community, they get gaslit, because I've literally seen conservative Black folks go up to, you know, forward-thinking white folks and tell them, you ain't from the hood, so how dare you come up here to East St. Louis or wherever and tell us Black folks how we're supposed to be. And, you know, people be like, well, I'm a back off, because I guess the hood don't want to have, it sounds like the hood wants Cop City. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the hood wants more police. So can we, I hope I contextualize this, like, right? Because this is where this battle is going to play out in ways that going to impact us for decades.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you're completely right. And I think, you know, I misstated this term earlier. It should be the Black misleadership class, which Glenn Ford famously sort of dubbed Black political elites, particularly in the Democratic Party. And so I think the role of this Black misleadership class, whether or not they're elected officials or Black preachers, has continually been to make our community more conservative and more beholden on moderate so-called traditional Democrats, right? Again, whether you are a fan of Obama or not, you have to remember back when Hillary Clinton was running how the Black leadership class stood up for Hillary Clinton, right? Because that was the person that they thought was going to win. Later on, when she ran against Bernie Sanders, the far more progressive candidate, again, you had Black leadership that stood up for the conservative, moderate candidate. And that's what our so-called political leaders have now represented. They no longer represent the interests of Black people, i.e. when Black folks first got some opening to participate in this electoral system in the 70s, where a lot of the elected officials, at least nominally, seemed to be far more connected to the interest and the politics, which were largely expressed through a form of Black radicalism in the 1960s and 70s. Those days are over. Like, that political time period has died. And we can see that even through the ways in which I think Cori Bush and the brother from New York, in terms of the representative,
Jamal Bowman.
Yeah. Again, you know, I probably am far more left than them, but they are left for the Democratic Party. How the Congressional Black leadership, the Congressional Black Caucus, did nothing when they were challenged, not by Republicans, but by the Democratic Party itself, by allowing these folks who already had the office to have challengers. The leadership of the Democratic Party said nothing. The leadership of the Black Congressional Caucus said nothing when pro-Israel interests poured in millions and millions of dollars, making those two House races at the time the most expensive House races in the history of the country, all to defeat Black progressives. And so even the small amount of Black progressives, when they come up, they don't get the support from the larger institutions. These institutions are bought and paid for, again, by developer interests, by capital interests who fund their campaigns, who tell them what's acceptable. And we have very few and far between leaders who actually have strong politics or real politics that can see that and break through that. I think with the election in New York, you're completely right. Like, I think there is a buy-off of the Black population. Even though Eric Adams is extremely unpopular, the Black misleadership class again decided to sit out the election. So they did not push Black folks to even listen to the young insurgent candidate that came about, right? They instead sat on the sidelines and did not say they were endorsing him over Eric Adams. And so that caused basically the Black community to either sit it out or to not vote for or not even listen or give a hearing to the young candidate that was running and who actually won the nomination for the Democratic Party. So I think there's a lot of purposeful propaganda and confusion within our community around what our interests are. And too many times people are suggesting that our interests are strictly within the Democratic Party and not left of the Democratic Party, that the best we can hope for is to get some moderate into office who, again, usually does nothing for our community anyway, and on international level sides with imperialism or imperialist U.S. interests, which involves the murder of other people who look more like us than the people who are actually dropping the bomb. So we have to understand that we're in a really perplexed propagandized system. And it is up to people who have voices to try to make sure that we can break out of that, because this leadership is not the leadership of our community.
You know, with Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman, you know, and we've seen that in a number of other races, including right here, you know, AIPAC type organizations got behind and put these folks in. But I think they were very smart in the sense that they pick people who can co-play Blackness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the complication comes in, even to the point, like, I'm not even comfortable using the word Black elite and all that, because those folks are those same folks, Hakeem Jeffries will say the Black elite and will make himself seem like he's standing right along Kamal Franklin in the No Cop City movement, right? Mm-hmm. Might even dress like that and hang out. And so there's this confusion, again, because what I think folks have studied is touching up on an emotional chord. And it gets complicated because you can find folks in these progressive or radical movements that have no connection with Blackness, and they can do things that come across wrong. Like, I often run into folks, it's like, oh man, y'all are praying to God. That's, you know, ain't no place for religion. It's like, well, brother, you know, it is in my house. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, they feel, we'll stand 10 toes down and state that. Or we'll see things that we culturally all do and not see the value in that, you know? And which results in people automatically circling the wagon, because you can say something that looks crazy and be like, I gotta circle the wagon. I ain't a fan of Eric Adams, but damn, they just use the N word, the B word, and 15 other words. So how have you all been able to, you know, to navigate that? How, what's been brought out in the book and that we can learn in terms of coalition building so that it is strong? Because this has obviously come up and you all have had to address it time and time again.
I would say, first of all, you know, a criticism of the Black left or left forces in general, but particularly out the Black left or the Black radical tradition, is that we've lost touch with the masses of our people. There are other politics that are much more conservative that do a better job of winning over the hearts and minds of our folks, right? You have you have politics like Eidos that at least online, like, what is it, American Descendants of Slaves, that at least online, you know, plays a bigger role in these discussions around Black politics than I would say Black radical politics often do at times, right? And I think you've had a corruption sometimes of Black radical politics, which has led people to have somewhat of a disbelief in the value of what people are doing, particularly folks who get a lot of resources but claim to be fighting for the hood or for our people or for the Black, but yet they seem to be living a certain lifestyle that doesn't seem to be equating with living or working for the community. So I'll leave it at that. But I think,
let me ask you one quick question. Hold your point, but I want to ask you a question. You know, this conservatism that we find in some of these new movements, right? Where you can get somebody like Lord Jamar from Brand Nubian sitting up there saying, I endorse Trump, right? But I only am down with, you know, fundamentally Black Americans or ADOs, you know, so that's a conservative movement. Something like that was on the fringe for a long time. And it wasn't until we started to see, one, that they were getting funding from the far left. Big shout out to Jared Ball and others for uncovering that. But we also saw that part of the play was for them to culturally signify to people that they were Black, right? Like, yo, I'm blackity black, black, black. Two, the amplification of their messages have come from white corporations. So online, Mark Zuckerberg, for example, will have on your feed every day lots of Black folks who me and you don't follow telling you to step back. We don't need to deal with ICE, even though out of Atlanta and out of these many places, it was defund the police and abolish ICE. People forget that that was the full saying, right? So now we have people like, yo, you know, we can't be, this ain't our fight. And they were saying that when we were protesting around Palestine, obliterating the longstanding relationship Black folks from the Panthers on down have had. And I'm sitting there going, why is this guy on my feed, but I don't see Kamal Franklin? I don't see none of the Cop City people on my feed ever. And I realized that they're amplifying these messages. So, you know, they got our algorithms, they got our profile. So every Black person is seeing that message and not seeing yours. Now, if me and you get up there and say ceasefire or free Palestine, all of a sudden we're shadow banned and we can't reach any of our people. But this amplification comes up. And then in legacy media, I remember when this conservative Adolf movement got wind, it was almost like somebody was trying to be edgy. And I think it was like CNN or the New York Times did a story. It was like, you know, I'm going to dig deep into the thing. I'm going to bypass the no cop movement. I'm going to bypass the Occupy movement or the Oscar Grant movement. Not going to talk to Ferguson. I'm going to put this movement up here. Give it visibility on the pages of the New York Times, because they did one of the first articles, and put them on CNN and legitimize them. And next thing you know, they're off and running. And, you know, I can't tell when's the last time I seen you all on some of those places to talk about a movement to, you know, that that you've been able to articulate. So outside forces have been very good at highlighting a lot of these conservative and backwards type of thinking, and literally picking, or at least presenting, the idea that these are the dying wall leaders of the community.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. You know, and my critique of the left is one side of that critique. Like, I think there are ways in which we need to do better in terms of digging in deep in our community. But the overwhelming way in which we've lost touch, you know, I just go back even a little bit farther, is the destruction of Black militant political movements in the 1960s and 70s that were literally destroyed through murder, political attacks on organizations, pitting organizations against each other, the propaganda, criminalizing movements, and so forth and so on. Those movements were destroyed, and what was left in their place again was the idea that the Democratic Party or voting was the only way in which we were necessarily supposed to be showing how we want to express our politics. But coming back to today, I think you're completely right. Like, even though I think conservatism is still a minority position, obviously there's some conservative values that Black folks have through our connection to church and so forth, but conservatism is still a minority position. And again, no matter what I think about Harris versus Trump, in terms of being two sides of the same coin, even when you look at the numbers of the Black folks who voted for Harris, right, the top two demographics that voted for Harris, Black women in overwhelming numbers, upwards of 90%. But people try to forget that Black men were second, right, in terms of the demographics, 85%, exactly. So, you know, people make a big deal and say, oh, well, they're losing the Black men to conservatism. But it's like, in any election, if 85% of you vote for one party, that's a huge like sweep, right? So I do think the role of corporate media, whether or not it's a legacy media and or newfound social media, is to minimize the Black left. It is to bring out a Black conservatism and a Black neoliberalism that allows people like Jeffries, Adams to a certain degree, people like Al Sharpton, to be considered the leaders of our community, and to pit those folks who, again, I don't think have the true interests of our community against the conservatives and or more wacky ideas. But it is never to lift up in any way whatsoever Black radicalism traditions, Black left voices, organizers that are calling for more more things to happen, let's say, whether it's in policy or in our communities, that is left of the Democratic Party. They've learned their lesson from the 60s and 70s, which is to not bring out to Black left, but to bring out caricatures of a certain politic and to let that represent something that anybody could sort of laugh off or not take seriously. But then to introduce, like you said, these conservative politics, which, you know, if they come across, and like you said, if someone is profiling as like they are from the hood, they're from the community, then of course somebody's going to take their time, whether it's cryptocurrency or other aspects of like this really conservative, get your money up first mentality that's been brought onto our community.
You know, I often think about, you know, what I read, which was the Senator Patrick, Daniel Patrick Moynihan memo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The memo that called for benign neglect, which was the pulling of the safety nets. And for people to know, Moynihan was a left-leaning Democrat who wrote a memo in 1970 to Richard Nixon. So when we do hip-hop history, we often talk about this memo. And in the memo, he was like, you know, take away the safety services. And he tells Nixon, you know, to stamp out this militarism. He says very directly, stop paying attention to Black militants. Mm-hmm. And then he lays out, he goes, talk to Native Americans, he used the word Indians, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans. They are more likely to assimilate. And then he says, he's very nuanced. He said there's a working class Black population that also wants to assimilate. And if you look at the memo, he talks about that there is there's a middle class strand of folks, college folks, who tend to hate white folks too. So watch out for them, right? And it's a very interesting thing because years later, it seems like that memo has been followed. Like, go to the barbershop and start telling people the world is flat and they'll believe it. And then go to these other folks and tell them, you know, show them videos of crime in Atlanta and they'll stay away from all that. And next thing you know, you have collective ignorance that's being orchestrated, you know, from people who follow the dictates of that memo. And how have you all been able to bridge those gaps in movement spaces and really come up with a coalition that's been, you know, pretty feisty at the very least, if not effective?
And I'll say one more thing about the Moynihan Report. Like, it was famous for, like you said, trying to move the larger Black community from militancy to trying to be a part of the, or integrated into the working class strata of America life. And so part of the report was offering jobs, particularly, and in a very patriarchal way, of particularly focusing on Black men for certain types of jobs, right? So yeah. I do think we've come to an era now where a lot of that stuff is not even being used anymore, because under the Trumpism, everybody has an order, and our order is way down the list as opposed to like the white working class or white moderates and the white wealthy. But I think, you know, going back to your original question, you know, one of the things that we've done is to do deep dive attempts at base building, right, within the Black community, which again, I think is a tradition that's been lost over the years. When we look at the most effective organizations in our community that have brought people to political consciousness to organize, you know, you look at the UNIA, you look at the you look at SNCC, you look at the Panthers. People don't remember, but SNCC actually, you know, folks, when they went to Mississippi, they actually moved to Mississippi, right? A lot of folks stayed past Freedom Summer and became part of the community. We've lost the idea that we need to base build in Black working class and poor communities. And we as CMB, community movement builders, we make the attempt to try to build with and in our communities as the primary way. Again, this is not easy organizing. This is not just because you come, they will follow type of organizing, but this is, we are a part of those communities. No matter if we are from Brooklyn or Oakland or any place else, our people like to distinguish our oppressions, but our oppressions are very similar no matter what part of the country you go, whether it's the South, the North, the East, or West. We try to base build with people in our community. And part of that led to, you know, one small victory out of the Cop City fight was that the person, the elected official, who was a Black woman who had been the city council person for upwards of like four terms, was defeated after she put that proposal. And that was the community that we worked in, right? We worked in that community and helped support the defeat. Now, it turned out the person that replaced her wasn't that great either, but he still was a little better than who she was. But I think that's, you know, in the coalition building around Cop City, you know, one of the things that when we all found out about what Cop City was and what we planned to do, there was an immediate pull from different directions of larger movement politics, right? Not just Black folks, but all folks who were concerned about over-policing, police brutality, criminalization of police, militarization of police. And so you had a political spectrum of people, everyday organizers or everyday people who were concerned about this, particularly people who were close to the force that was going to be deforested, to anarchists, to like radicals, to environmentalists, right? To voting rights people. All of those groups were part of, somewhat a part of the original grouping of people who just started organizing and protesting to stop Cop City. And I will say, you know, I point this out in the book, one, I think, of the failures of community movement builders and our larger movement is that we were not able to move a big enough mass of Black people. It wasn't the same type of movement that happens after a Black person has been killed, or George Floyd was killed, or Rashad was killed, where there was a mass mobilization, right? We obviously moved some people, and I think some poll numbers showed that, but we were never able to generate the type of movement that I think was needed to offset the development of Cop City, particularly in a city that was controlled by what I will call the Black elites and or the Black misleadership class.
How much of the rallying of Black folks in a place like Atlanta around initially George Floyd, but Rashad Brooks and others, where people are in the streets, how much of that is orchestrated by those neoliberal Black politicians to bring about an election So there's a fanning of the flames and maybe even some stealth organizing to get people out in the streets. And I asked this Kamal Franklin, who's our guest, how do you be in the streets talking about no more police and, you know, justice for George Floyd or justice for Rashad Brooks, or, you know, we can go back to the days of Eleanor Bumpers. And I mean, well, that was New York, but mm-hmm. the other sister, mm-hmm. the other woman that was killed in Atlanta, Kathy, whatever her name was. I'm trying, I don't want to besmirch her name, but yeah. 90 years old and was killed by police. I'm trying to make sense of how do you go from that to Cop City? What's the selling point? How do you get that? How do I come to you and say, you know, defund the police, you know, lock them up, justice for George Floyd. Hey, Kamal, you know what? I think it'd be a good idea if we, you know, have a huge, you know, huge expansive Cop City type of, you know, endeavor where people can train and we're going to go along with it. How did Keisha Bottoms sell that?
Yeah. Well, one, she was never for the rallies and demonstrations, particularly the more militant type. So, and I think most of the politicians, what they do is that they jump on board of something in which they see mass protests offering a more conservative outlook around what the results of that protest should be, i.e. better training for the police, i.e. better facilities for the police. And they mostly want to control. Like, we had Black politicians during the height of the George Floyd and Rayshard Brooks rallies doing marches for dignity, where they would all dress in suits and ties and say, we are dignified and we are human beings.
The respectability
politics, exactly. So that's the role that the Black elite and/or Black elected officials usually play in these demonstrations, right? They don't play the role of calling for the ending of police, but calling for our so-called rights to be respected, right? We're doing the hands up type marches. So that is the role that they play. And when they see that they cannot necessarily jump in front and control the movement, then like any elite force or a force tied to capitalism and tied to development, then they will bring out the guns. And we mean that literally, right? And so, you know, we go from a propaganda stick to an overt militarized stick. And that militarized stick was, if we can't get them off the streets with through propaganda, then we're going to build what we see as the necessary training facility needed so that we can do a better job of sweeping the streets of people so that commercial or commerce can continue unabated. They were happy when we're off the streets and we're looking at the TVs and we're buying and we're being good consumers and we're looking at entertainment programs. But the moment we think as a people, right, that we should play a leading role in decision making on policy and interests, that is when, you know, it is time to bring out the police and bring out the big stick. So these folks play a particular role, but is never the leading force of organizing. They're never making the more radical calls. And at most, and you can see this through a lot of the sort of the recent history of these, the calling for defunding, at most, they would allow certain programs that would be part of the police budget that says, okay, let's have, and some of these are decent, but they're not, again, they're not radical programs, but let's have other folks come out and even it's a homeless situation or a situation where there's a mental health issue, maybe have somebody else come out and see them as opposed to the cops first, right? Again, not mad at that, but that is the extent of where they will go with their agencies or with their agency in terms of their positions to try to change the budget. But they're usually lockstep with yeah. their more conservative partners, the Republicans at the state level. Remember, both here in Georgia, Brian Kemp was a big supporter of Cop City. And so from Keisha Lance Bottoms to Andre Dickens, they both worked closely with the state agencies.
That's where the confusion comes in, Kamal, because I'm sitting there going, first, when you're organizing and you're going door to door, are people seeing that sharp contradiction? That's one question. Mm-hmm. Second, the Brian Kemps and the conservative forces, the MAGA folks, the Trump forces have done everything they can to upend Black leadership, you know, whether you call it Black misleadership or whatever, but they've like, we'll defund you, we'll make you look bad, we'll run people against you, we'll tie your hands so you can't make moves, all this sort of stuff they do. which, you know, sometimes leads to people circling the wagon, you know, because we could see the attacks. But at the same time, I'm trying to figure out how you're doing a dance with that devil in that way and being cool with it. How are you sitting up there? Yeah, you know, me and Brian, we went to lunch and we're going to build some Cop City, when he's the same guy that tried to run you out of office and criminalize you and do everything he can legislatively to cripple you.
I think orientation, I mean, the first part of your question is, I do think we were able to move Black folks on this issue. And that was shown through polls that we did internally. When people looked at the polls on people who are against Cop City, or the polls around for or against Cop City, the breakdown would be the majority of Black folks would be against Cop City and the majority of white folks would be for. Now, the plurality of Black folks against it was smaller than the overwhelming majority of white folks who were for Cop City, right? And so those polls will always be close. But we saw in those polls that in spite of the propaganda of having the mayor support this, having city council and business leaders support this, that the majority of Black citizens did not support it. And again, we often see that in all polling. The things that progressive people, that people want that are progressive, usually went out in polls. It doesn't mean that elected officials will go out and do those things, but they usually went out in polls. Healthcare, a raising of the minimum wage, those things are usually, no matter who's being polled, right, across the country, the majority of people who so-called Americans want those things, but the politicians do not enact those things. Again, I think the role of the Black politician, particularly the Democratic politician, is not the liberation of Black people. They are more beholden to what they think will keep them in office and making deals with the Republicans and with the capitalist class. And so I think it is a misnomer, in my opinion, at this stage to think that these politicians are innately supportive of the interests of the larger Black community. I think they are innately supportive of a worldview which is limited around what does it mean for a city to progress. And for most of these folks, it means more corporations coming to their city, more middle-class people moving into their city who now work for these corporations, the pushing out of poor people, the pushing out of homeless people, the bringing in the big sports stadiums and the big events. And for them, the mindset is, this is success. It is not solving the problems of poor people. It is not solving the problems, which the state has the capacity to do through the resources it has to redirect those resources. So I think there's a mindset and to a political consciousness, which is lacking amongst most, not only Black politicians, but all politicians in terms of their class interests and conservative nature of the politics of America. So I think that plays a big role. I don't think these politicians are struggling innately with, like, you know, Black liberation politics or helping and supporting Black folks. I think they think they are doing something good because that is the mindset and or the political consciousness that they have, even if you can show over and over again that it doesn't help Black people, that's where they're locked into.
But it sounds like there's an aspect of they are innately transactional. Would I be wrong in thinking that?
I think they are trained up to be transactional. I wouldn't use the word innately, but I think the propaganda that, again, most of us experience and go through, that when they run for these office, they are at that stage true believers in a transactional and or a limited sense about what progress means. And usually it means transactions with corporate developers, the corporate and capitalist class.
So I ask that because the transactional aspect in terms of how I'm thinking is one in which you go, well, I want to stay in office another 4 years. I want to stay in office another 2 years. And I think maybe it's a naive dreaming or hopeful thinking that if you could go out and you can get, there's 1,000 people on the block, right? And 100 people got this person elected. So all you have to do, Kamal, is get at least 300 or 400 people to vote. And then that politician, Black, white, or whatever, who is dependent upon these votes that you now control, will do your bidding. They will say bye-bye to AIPAC, bye-bye to Coca-Cola, and be like, we need to do a dance with Kamal and his voting block of 400. And if he says no Cop City, I'm going to have to do it. And people often like to point to that that story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt telling Martin Luther King, or I mean, A. Philip Randolph, you know, mm-hmm. if you want these concessions, make me do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is that train gone? Do we have the numbers in progressive or radical or militant spaces that if they just went to the polls, they could change the dynamic? Or is that train left and we, you know, it's just not going to work and it's a waste of time?
I don't think that train is completely gone. But I think there are other overwhelming factors that displace the possibilities of that being the only way in which we achieve political power, right? So again, using Bowman and Cori Bush as examples, they were very well loved in Black community. And what happened?
But nobody came up, but when you look at
those polls, they were redistricted. Right? So they lost a large amount of their Black.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bowman wasn't redistricted. This people didn't come out and vote in the numbers that they could.
Corey
ran up against Wesley Bell, right? So it wasn't so much a redistricting. He was in that district too, you know, because he was either the prosecutor or whatever in Ferguson. And a member we had her on, maybe there was a redistricting, but I do know that a lot of people just didn't go to the polls. A lot of folks was like, yeah, mm-hmm. I know, but I ain't bothering.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be, that irked me when I saw mm-hmm. the low turnout of voters for both
I
of
do,
them.
Yeah. So I'll say for four of hers, she was redistricted. And again, literally for both of them, millions, literally tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, if I'm not mistaken, at least tens of millions were poured into these House races to defeat them. And so this wasn't just a sense of getting your constituency out. These were people who were brought and paid for to go out and get other folks to come out and vote against them and or to confuse the issue and make them stay home. So
well,
this was not just power.
Thing.
Yeah.
Because there was low turnout in both those mm-hmm. in both those mm-hmm. places. Mm-hmm. So millions of dollars were spent, right,
mm-hmm.
doing all this stuff. And so you didn't get large numbers of people going, yes, let me get behind, you know, these oppositional candidates. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just didn't vote at all. So I'm wondering if, as you said, there was confusion or if there was a stealth campaign to sit up there and send somebody to the barbershop who, you know, the proverbial barbershop, and say, yeah, man, I ain't voting. Ain't no, you know, I mean, there are people that get paid to do those things.
Oh, yes, yeah. Confusion, stealth, again, across the board strategies to limit the ability of these progressives to get back in office. Right. And again, funded with the tens of millions of dollars from AIPAC and other folks. And again, remember also, the leadership of the Black Congressional Caucus did not make trips out to these areas and say, vote for these people. These folks are already elected Democrats. They have the interest of our community at heart. We need to stand up and support them. They didn't challenge the Democratic leadership in that respect. They said nothing, they did nothing. And so they allowed these folks to be primaried, knowing that with the millions of dollars of resources that was pitted against them, that the likely outcome was going to be their defeat, right? And they could have done something in terms of like, done something that was outside of raising tens of millions of dollars. They could have raised more money on the left side of the aisle. And again, they could have made personal appearances. They could have made commercials. That was just not the case. And so these brought off elected officials, leadership level elected officials did nothing, particularly again, the Black caucus did nothing to support members of their own caucus. And if I remember, Bowman was defeated by a white candidate, and I know Corey was defeated by a Black candidate, but one who actually promised not to run and not to do all that kind of stuff and then broke the pledge and ran against her anyway. So we have to see that, yes, there is a way in which we, again, need to base build and have control of votes and be more united and stuff like that. But we also have to understand that that there is a systematic approach that has millions of dollars that is looking to at all times come after us. And because we are poorly resourced and you know, quite frankly, poorly organized, and we're usually having battles with each other as opposed to the state, you know, we are always more likely or not, at least in this era, to not be able to hold that base together, right? And I think, but I don't think you're wrong. I think there is still a way in which, you know, I'm not a huge player of electoral politics, but I still think that there is a role that electoral politics plays, and that we have to do a better job. I'll give one quick example. Like, you know, Chokwe Lumumba Sr., when he ran for mayor, was able to captivate a certain amount of the Black electorate that, in spite of the propaganda, and Chokwe had left-wing politics far more radical than most or anybody. Charles Barron was able to demonstrate that, who had far more radical politics and actually played those politics out in very positive ways for the larger Black community, keeping East New York to be the only area of New York City that did not gentrify was because of Charles and Inez Barron, who were both city council member and state representatives. And so there is some demonstrative models of what successful left, militant, radical Black politics can look like in the electoral arena. Our bigger question is, how do we duplicate those things? And how do we make those things national in scope?
Real talk. Thank you so much, Kamal. Tell everybody how they can get a hold of you. I know you do your own show and all that.
Yeah, they can get a hold of us on Black Liberation Media, which is our YouTube channel. We have different shows that are around Black radical tradition. The organization Community Movement Builders is communitymovementbuilders.org, and we are on all social media, and you can find us there.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We're out for now. Peace.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated!